Yeah, okay. Yeah, thank you. So Roxanne got scared about this 100 slides. So I give this talk again in Seattle next week. And you may know at the University of Washington, there are experts on EDMs for the Mercury. And there are experts on storage ring. Dave Herzer with the Muon G-2. So I prepared a lot of spare slides for the discussion there. But of course, I can also show them here. So I talk about electric dipole moment measurements in storage rings. That means, of course, that I talk about charged particles. Storage ring, of course, Brad Filippone talked about neutral particles. So I'm from Aachen and Jülich. Some of you travel to Jülich next week, yeah, just to give you an idea where you go, because maybe it's not so known. So that shows a map of Central Europe. Actually, around the year 800. So this is Charlemagne's, how do you say Charlemagne or Charles the Great?
Charlemagne.
Charlemagne is French, and Charles the Great, I also read.
The French get to decide how to say it.
Karl der Große, no, the Germans, come on. So Karl der Große, so that is, I think this light green was this empire when he took over from his father, and this green is then when he died.
But then Jülich and Aachen should be in French.
Well, Aix-la-Chapelle sounds much nicer than Aachen, of course. Yes. Okay. Well, it's a big discussion whether he was French or German. He was European, so let's take it like this. And of course, I show this map because Charlemagne, he chose Aachen as his capital. Well, Jülich played not that important role at the time, so I had to edit by hand here. So, so as a reference for the physicists, so Geneva would be here. Yeah. Vic Gemeins is here, if you remember, yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, I cannot resist. That is the nice city of Belgium here.
Yeah. We'll listen to Brexit after all this.
Sorry?
Then there was Brexit.
Well, yeah.
Clearly it's not included.
Well, it's not included, so it, okay. Yeah. So that shows, not a picture of Aachen University, actually that shows the Aachen Cathedral. And this part here, it's an octagon structure that was really built in 800. And I read about Seattle next week. The Space Needle used to be the tallest building west of Mississippi. So that is like our Space Needle. It used to be the tallest building with 30 meter height north of the Alps at the time for 200 years. So, let's get back to the university. So RWTH stands for Rheinisch-Westfälische, that refers to the region where we are located, Technische Hochschule. So it was founded in 1870. We have about 40,000 students, and the total population is 250,000. So you see that it plays quite an important role, and it's the largest technical university in Germany. Jülich is one of the largest interdisciplinary research centers in Europe. That's what you find on Wikipedia. Well, 6,000 staff members and 2,000 scientists. This ratio always scares me. I don't know what the other 4,000. Different issue. And so that shows kind of the campus in Jülich. Institute for Nuclear Physics is here, and the accelerator where we do our experiment is located in this hall here. And on the web page, you find this nice statement, Forschungszentrum Jülich works on key technologies for the current challenges facing society in the fields of information, brain, as well energy and environment. That sounds nice, but EDMs, they don't fit in this sentence. So we are, well, threatened to be shut down in a few years because we don't contribute to brain, society, or energy, or whatever.
Definitely not to society.
Sorry?
Definitely not to society.
Well, I don't know, but not in the view of the new management. Okay. Yeah, about the physics. So I have an introduction, what EDMs are, what we know about EDMs, and why are they interesting. I think for this audience, maybe can go a bit faster over these slides. Then I talk about experimental methods. And as I said, I try to explain you how to measure charged particle EDMs. We had a lot of talks on the conference on neutral particles, atoms, molecules, neutrons. So that is a rather new field. And then, while I cannot show you final results because it's a long way to go, as you will see in this part here, but we have some achievements, and the thing I would like to show you how we can manipulate and measure polarization with high precision. You see, of course, it's all about measuring somehow spin. And you see there is an exclamation mark and no question mark here for the other subtitles. Okay, so what are EDMs? Of course, they are just the separation of positive and negative charges. And classically, you the vector is defined like this. And in naive view, if you would like to know what is the electric dipole moment, let's say, of a water molecule, when you take the separation of or the extension of the size of the object, which is 1 angstrom, we have a charge of 1 elementary charge, and if you multiply these two numbers, you get to 10^-8 e centimeters. These are the units which we, for some unknown reason, we still use also in nuclear physics, centimeters and not Fermis. Well, the number, it looks more impressive if you use centimeters instead of Fermis. And actually, the water molecule has electric dipole moment of this size, so it fulfills this naive expectation. So let's go to hadron physics. So the neutron, take a neutron, or well, any hadron actually. So the size is, of course, much smaller, 10^-13 centimeters. So the naive expectation is then 10^-13 e centimeters. But up to now, we didn't observe any EDM for a fundamental particle, or elementary particle. The actual limit is 13 orders of magnitude lower than this naive expectation. Of course, that raises the question, why is that so? And of course, it has to do with the transformation properties of the operator. The dipole operator is odd under parity transformation. The immediate consequence is that in a state of a given parity, its expectation value is zero. Yeah. But if you have a ground state, which is a mixture of parities, of two parity states, this matrix element may be non-zero. And that is essentially what happens in molecules. Yeah.
But it's probably better to mention the time reversal, because it's more stringent limit than parity. Parity is broken in weakened direction, right?
Yeah.
And time reversal is broken at the next level of smallness.
Okay. I come, of course, to time reversal, that it also violates time reversal, but just to explain this naive calculation. Of course, for a molecule that is ammonia, you can imagine that the ground state is a mixture of this state and this state. So this state, if you describe it in a simple model, the wave function of these three hydrogen atoms, it would look like this for this state, it would look like this for this state, and the ground state is then just a mixture of these two parity states, which are almost degenerate. Okay, so molecules can have a large EDM because of degenerated ground state with different parity, and elementary particle, and I include hadrons, always a discussion, what is elementary particles? For me, proton and neutron are elementary particles. They have a definite parity and cannot possess an EDM. Of course, unless you violate, for some reason, parity.
Molecules have ground states which have definite parity. So therefore, in the ground state, the expectation value of the dipole moment is zero. You see this dipole moment through the transition between parity doublet.
Yeah.
So this is of course.
It's a non-stationary.
For the theorist, there should be Mirkov. Of course, you have a ground state which has a definite parity, you have a first excited state which is very close to this. So as soon as you have an electric field, of course, you start with a very, very tiny electric field. You start with a quadratic Stark effect. It becomes linear, and at finer temperatures, you get also this measure.
I think there are at least 4 escape paths. First of all, a finite electric field. If a field, electric field is larger than a gap, you have degeneracy. Finite temperature, if the temperature is larger than the gap, you have degeneracy. Finite measuring time.
Finite temperature.
If for a crystal, you know, even a crystal would not have a dipole moment. Finite measuring time. Heisenberg, you escape this system. And the fourth that people forget, finite lifetime of a measurer and of a system. For instance, there are some molecules, even homonuclear molecules, that have a measured EDM. The reason why they escape this theorem is because they live for a finite time. So the tunneling is not fast enough, or the tunneling is too small to resolve the gap on the system lives shorter than the timing would allow you to give a splitting of a gap. So these are at least, maybe you find another one, but at least four ways to escape the field.
But in life scientists, like say, you know, this say sugar, right? Sugar is also Blake's parity, right?
Yeah.
Because the one we are using is chiral, right? So it's similar. But what were you referring to? Right?
So in my argumentation, the ground state and the first excited state are degenerate for practical reasons. Okay.
But you see, the difference is that whether certain symmetry is broken or not broken. Mm-hmm. When you have degeneracy, you can say that it's like spontaneous breaking of the symmetry.
Yeah.
It's not breaking of the symmetry.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
But when we are looking for, say, dipole moment of neutron, for example, it is indeed a breaking of the symmetry.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
It's not, because it's
so you can get
degeneracy there.
You can get EDMs for the molecules without breaking the symmetries, but for elementary particle, you need to break both symmetries.
What happens when you reverse the electric field?
Yeah, so here it would flip the electric dipole moment, here it wouldn't. Here it goes with the modulus of the electric field, and here the sign plays a role. Okay, I think we all agree. For an experimentalist, I think that is. Okay, so you have, if you want to get an EDM for an elementary particle, so you have to break P and, as I show in a minute, also T invariants. And for me, the easiest way to see this is if you write down the Hamiltonian in the rest system of the particle. So first of all, if an EDM exists, it has to be parallel or antiparallel to the spin vector or the projection. And if you write down then the Hamiltonian, an interaction with the B field and the E field. So of course the B field couples to the magnetic moment, the E field to the electric dipole moment, and when you do a T or P transformation, this term flips signs, but the magnetic part does not.
Well, you have to explain, of course, that there's only one vector at the disposal in the rest frame. That's the spin.
That is the spin. Okay. That is the reason why it
otherwise,
has to be parallel.
This argument would not work.
Okay, and the same thing is shown here in a nice picture. So EDM measurements that test the violation of fundamental symmetries P and T, and of course T is equivalent to CP if you assume that the CPT theorem holds. We know CP violation, of course, and there is always a connection to EDMs. So there is in the standard model CP violation in the CKM matrix. Well, it turns out that that is unobservably small, that leads to unobservably small EDMs, which is actually good. It sounds bad, but it's good because if you see an EDM, you know it's something below this line here. So either you find a finite theta QCD term, actually the best limit now comes from the neutron EDM limit, or you find even more, you find physics beyond the standard model. And for many models that predict EDMs in the reach of future or even of present experiments. Okay, for me I find it always interesting to look why is the EDM so small in the standard model. So if you try to invent interactions, so you have the electric field, the photon comes from the electric field, you couple here through a D quark, and you would like to get a CP violating interaction only with the tools of the standard model without the without theta QCD, you have to write a diagram like this. That is the easiest one, I was told. So you have to have four weak vertices to get CP violation. So it's very hard. So therefore, in the standard model, it's suppressed. And of course, in supersymmetric models, such a simple diagram is enough to generate EDMs. Okay, there's also a connection, of course, to cosmology, mainly the matter-antimatter asymmetry. So this so-called baryon asymmetry, which is just the number of baryons minus the number of antibaryons divided by the number of photons, is measured to be this order, 10 to minus 10. And what is called the standard cosmological model would only give 10 to minus 18. So it fails to explain the observed dominance of matter in our universe. And of course, Sakharov pointed out that to get a baryon, antibaryon asymmetry, you need, among other things, CPU violation. So finding an EDM could help to solve this problem. Okay, so what do we know about EDMs? So I tried to make a compilation of all measurements we know. So on the x-axis you have the different particles. Here you have the EDM, and the red triangles are experimental upper limits. So 90 or 95% confidence limit on this scale, which goes over 15 orders of magnitude. It doesn't matter whether it's 90 or 95%. So you have the electron. Actually, this means that the electron was not measured directly, but it was measured in this kind of molecules. They have the muon, the tau, neutron, proton. Again, there's no direct measurement on the proton. It was measured or deduced from a measurement from mercury. There's the lambda and there's the deuteron. And what else is shown? Here are Ben's predictions from the standard model. As I told you, they are essentially zero. The experimental limits we have now, so many orders of magnitude below. And this blue band gives a range of SUSY prediction.
Do you know which SUSY that is?
I think a simple formula where you, so the variance comes if you vary this phi, it's tangens phi and the typical mass, and that's all. So, and you see if you take this series, then especially the electron EDM measurement excludes already part of these predictions. And what you also see that there is no measurement for the deuteron, and there's no direct measurement for the proton.
But this supersymmetric prediction is normalized to what? Because you need to normalize it to some T breaking metric, right? So which one, can you tell which one they are using to, you know, to fix the scale?
Which scale? For the SUSY?
No, because I mean, CP violation in supersymmetric model is also governed by certain parameters, right? I mean, so in this way, it's not a magic.
What I have here, I could show my spare slides, you see. So you get a CP violating phase, and then 200 GeV, I don't know why the 200 GeV, it would have to look up the reference.
We can
go again, a SUSY bars, and I don't know what TeV or what was put here. Mm-hmm. So if you now, if you vary this phase in this region, then you get, for the neutron at least, you get this band. That is, yeah. But the point is, the only point I would like to make, there are serious models beyond the standard models which predict EDMs in the range the experiments can reach. Right? Don't care about the order of magnitude here. Yeah?
How's the lambda EDM?
Well, lambda was, of course, I put the lambda because if we measure proton and deuteron somewhere here, it looks good to have a measurement which is worse. That was done in 1980. There's one paper on it, and they just look at lambda decays. They have a magnetic field, so precession, yeah. I was thinking about at COMPASS, we have a lot of lambdas, so one could do it better 25 years later, but I never had the time to look into this. Get a few thousand lambdas and looked into this.
And it's not gonna, I mean, it's not gonna be significantly, it's not gonna be.
No, you probably you don't get, you right. Don't get here.
No. Right.
Yeah. So it's I think the oldest reference that is from 1980. Okay, so what we would like to do, to measure charged hadrons. So the reason is there is no direct measurements for charged hadrons, and there's no measurement at all for the deuteron. And well, the goal is somewhere to start here using an existing machine, a magnetic machine, COSY, which I will show in a minute, and then eventually go to build a dedicated storage ring, which could reach this limit here of 10 to minus 29. This gray band should indicate that we will not start day one and get this limit, or with the final ring to get this limit. We probably start somewhere here, which would be in the region of the muon, which was done at the storage ring, and then hope to improve year by year, I don't know how many orders of magnitude. Because you will see in the course of this talk that it's not that straightforward. Okay, so that is the idea. Of course, you may ask now, we have so many measurements, why do you want to add another measurement? I think Andreas explained this chart. So you have all this measurement, and you would like to come to the fundamental theory. So if one day somebody measures somewhere an EDM here, it would be nice, would be a major discovery, but you never get here. So you need a set of all measurements to disentangle everything and to go back to the real source of the EVM. So what I just said is also written here. So there is no direct measurement of a charge state ones. Compared to neutrons, one can potentially do better. The neutrons decay, so you have a limited measurement time, and you get more stored protons or deuterons than neutrons. And on the theory side, of course, it's, as explained on the previous slide, it's also complementary. One day one would like to test this kind of relation. So is the deuteron EDM the sum of proton and neutron of the same order of magnitude?
If you would have that, then you would not have an access to lambda.
Well, what the point I would like to make, if it's an order of magnitude larger, then the sum of proton or proton and neutron measurement, you know that it's not lambda QCD, it must be something else. Okay, so the bottom line is that the EDM of one single particle is not enough to disentangle or to identify CP violating sources.
If the equation sign is valid, then only the quark EDM can do that. I mean, any other one would be excluded.
Okay. Yeah. Now,
but in neutron, you still can believe that it is a loosely bound system. So there you can calculate.
We have calculated it.
Right.
We have.
Yeah.
We have done the calculation, therefore I was insisting on it.
Yeah.
I know exactly, if I would know proton neutron,
yeah,
I can predict for you the neutron for the theta term.
I see.
So if
that's of course not exactly, I mean.
So the correct statement is if you have proton and neutron, you can predict the deuteron if only the theta term is involved.
Yeah.
And
if your prediction fails, you know something else.
I can also predict left right, and I can extract parameters.
Okay.
No, guys, in this sense, it's like nuclear field. So one, you believe that neutrons in deep kind of loosely bound system is a large radius, then the accuracy of prediction is probably very high, right? Relatively high. So in this way, it's not, you would not expect violation of.
Well, the reason is field body system. We can also do it for the helium free and triton.
Mm-hmm.
So let's come to the measurements. The number of questions will drop now, probably. Or increase, I don't know, because you're less familiar with this. So how do you measure an EDM? Of course, it is true for every particle, so you have to interact with an electric field. That is trivial. If not, you don't get access to an EDM. For neutral particle, of course, if you apply an electric field, you still can keep them in a small volume, in a trap. For a charged particle, the trap becomes a storage ring because you want to apply a large electric field to enhance the effect, and that means you get a lot of acceleration, so your particle will escape your small volume. So the easiest thing you could imagine is you build a ring, storage ring, so the size would be like 10, 20, 30, 50 meters, whatever, but something which does not fit in this room. And you have a radial electric field, which guides the particle on a circle. And let's discuss now a simple case. You have now, you inject spin polarized ensemble, so the spins are aligned with the momentum vector. And then due to an EDM, you get a torque. So the spin vector or the polarization vector will tilt out of the plane of the accelerator. So if you just wait long enough, you observe a buildup of a vertical polarization, which is proportional to the EDM. Yeah. Of course, in general, it's much more complicated because you have also magnetic moment, you may also have magnetic fields, but that is the general idea. Electric field, particles on a circle, and you observe a vertical buildup.
Magnetic field precession is in the plane, right?
Sorry?
The precession, your magnetic field.
Yeah, I come to this. That, of course, disturbs, makes it more difficult. But in a simple particle, with a particle with no magnetic moment, that would work. And it works even for a particle with magnetic moment, as I can show you in a second. Okay, that is very simple, but at least it's enough just to estimate how far you could get statistically. Yeah. So what you need, the experimental requirements, is, of course, a high-precision storage ring. I'll talk about systematics in a minute. And to estimate the statistical error, just have to assume some numbers so that you get, let's say, the order of 10 to 10 particles per fill in the storage ring, which is possible. Polarization of 80%, of course, they have to be polarized. If not, you cannot observe an effect. You have to have a very long spin coherence time, and we did some measurement on this. Spin coherence time means if your ensemble, if not 10 particles with spins, they enter your storage region, and they should not decohere. So what they do, if you don't do anything, after 1,000 seconds or after 100 seconds even, they point in all the directions because they have different momenta and things like this. So you have to make sure that you really have this long measurement time to get a precise measurement. You need large electric fields of the order of 10 megavolt per meter. And of course, at the end, you have to measure your vertical polarization. The classical method to do this is just to scatter the particles of a carbon target. And there you reach, depending on the energy, analyzing powers of the order of 60%. So nature is kind to us. That's rather easy. And efficiency factors of 0.5%, roughly. So if you plug all these numbers in, then you get for a single fill, or for a single measurement of 1,000 seconds, you get this statistical error. And for 1 year, if you do this many times, you get really down to this level of 10 to minus 29 e centimeters, which was the desired goal. I showed a few slides before. So that is where this number comes from. Actually, it comes from the fact that the neutrons proposed 10 to minus 28, and people who proposed charged particles were told, if you cannot do an order of magnitude better, forget about it. So that is how you get to the 10 to minus 29. So I think the statistical part is rather easy. Yeah, the systematics is the real challenge, as for all the EDM experiments. I think statistics you can get.
And theory.
No, theory for the measurement, it does not play a role.
For theory, also with systematics.
Okay. So the real challenge is to get the systematics to the same level. And just to give you an idea.
Can I ask?
Yeah, of course.
How many candidate storage rings are there around the world? How many places can you do this sort of experiment?
Two. I come to this, yeah. Okay. Well, one is Jülich and the other is floating from BNL to Fermilab, Korea. Yeah.
I have a very naive question.
Yeah, of course.
Neutron, of course, will polarize in the electric field because the center of mass of neutron is different from center of charge. So yeah. There is a normal static dipole moment in the neutron, right? So this will provide a normal star shift, which would be much greater than energy which we are discussing here. So how does it disturb, actually, your measure?
It's not T, by the way.
You're talking about the...
Okay, it's not
there, but when you reverse the field, it'll average out.
That would be the polarizability then, or?
You're talking about the induced...
Just normal star
shift,
yeah.
The polarizability.
Yeah.
Which is not T-validated,
yeah.
All the experiments, whether done in trap or elsewhere, they always do this reversals.
Yeah. Okay.
I think even the effect is smaller because these polarizabilities, when they are measured for hadrons, you scatter over lead nucleus and just calculate. I just did it at the beginning of the program. Calculate the electric field 5 Fermi from a lead nucleus. That is orders of magnitude higher than what we can get here. So I think proton and neutron are quite rigid objects. Okay. So the systematics is the real issue. So, of course, the particle has a magnetic moment, all the particles, whether you take neutron, proton, whatever. And, of course, if you have a magnetic moment and you have a radial magnetic field, you also get a buildup of your polarization due to the magnetic moment. Yeah? Of course, even if you build a pure electric field, you still have stray magnetic field from the Earth's magnetic field or from wherever. And you see the effect you measure from the EDM equals, at some point, for a given radial field, it equals the effect from the magnetic moment. And suppose we had an EDM of 10 to minus 29 centimeters, an electric field of 10 megavolt per meter, then you can calculate that a radial field of 10 to minus 17 tesla does the same effect as the EDM. and 10^-17 Tesla, the Earth's magnetic field, 10^-4 Tesla, is nothing. And you cannot just go there with an NMR probe to measure this. You can maybe go to 10^-6, 10^-7. So see, that is the real challenge. Well, the clever idea is to use a clockwise and a counterclockwise beam, which you can do in a pure electric field. Think about it. You don't need antiparticles. But when you first hear about it, you think that doesn't work. You need antiprotons. No, for electric field, it works. It works, of course. And maybe I show this next slide. And if you store your particles, you know that the vertical force is zero on the particle because you store it. So the vertical force can come from three different components. You have, of course, the gravity, which plays also a role here. Yeah. You have vertical electric fields from quadrupoles you need in the ring, and you may have radial electric fields, radial magnetic fields. And of course, the electric field, gravity, they act in the same direction for both particles, but the radial magnetic field will drive these two particles apart. And at least on paper, you can reach the sensitivity to get to this 10^-, equivalent of 10^-17 Tesla by just looking, or by just making sure that the two beams run on the same trajectory.
But yeah. Can you measure it without electric field to see this, to measure this radial magnetic field? I mean, put an electric field zero, say. You see that you can experiment without electric field as well, right?
So, but then you don't get the...
Yeah, and to see whether there is this vertical component.
But how do you measure without electric field? You don't have your storage ring anymore. You don't.
No. You're analyzing polarization, and if you see that your polarization goes out of the plane, right, without electric field, then it would be evidence for magnetic field, radial magnetic field.
Well, he thinks about a pure magnetic ring.
Yeah, I talk about this, that you can also use pure magnetic rings. Okay, so that is the basic idea to fight systematics, that you have beams running clockwise and counterclockwise. That cancels a lot of the systematic contributions. Okay, now let me just go back to this slide. So here I showed the simple picture with the spin evolution in the presence for electric field and electric dipole moment. In general, the equation is much more complicated, and the spin motion is governed by the Thomas BNT, where BNT stands for Barkow-Michel-Tilecki equation. And, well, you see, in general, of course, you have not only electric fields, but you have also magnetic fields, denoted by B. And you not only have an electric dipole moment, but also a magnetic dipole moment. And this capital G is just the magnetic anomaly, so G minus 2, if you want, divided by 2. And so that is your working horse, which is good and bad, because good, you have many possibilities. Bad, every week another colleague comes with a new idea how one could measure the EDM. I just present quickly three possibilities. So the first one is to use this pure electric ring. That means this term goes away. This term goes away. You still have this term here. But you see, if you choose, gamma is, of course, the Lorentz factor for a particle with a positive anomalous magnetic moment, you can choose appropriate energy, and so that this term cancels. And for protons, you can do this. For protons, this so-called magic momentum is 0.7 GeV. And then you have really the situation I showed in the beginning. You have a radial electric field, and you have no spin precession due to the magnetic moment in the plane. Yeah, that is a clever idea. And so that I call pure electric ring. No B field needed. You can really have clockwise, counterclockwise beams running in the same space at the same time, which is a big advantage. I think for the neutron, you have to flip some electric field. You do one measurement, you do the next measurement. For this mercury, you have different cells which are separated in space. So here we can really do this. Yeah.
I just have any questions. So what about the interactions between the beams?
You can neglect this. They're 10^10 particles, and I don't know, extension of the beam of 1 millimeter, that does not play a big role. Yeah.
But they are at different trajectories? Or
no, yes, they should be on the same trajectory, to see exactly the same field at the same time.
It's like different bunches?
Yeah, yeah, of course, you have bunches, of course. Yeah. So they cross from time to time. Mm-hmm. Okay.
They are bunched, of course, around the trajectory. Mm-hmm. Yeah. you know, what is it, on perfect trajectory, and most of the particles are.
Okay, so that works, of course, only for protons. If you look at hadrons, at least it doesn't work for neutron or for deuterons, because it has a negative anomaly. The second option, if I just go back to this equation, is to choose a combination of magnetic and electric fields so that, again, this part goes away. Yeah, then you have several choices. That is a so-called combined ring. So it works for not only for proton, it works for everything. It requires both E and B fields. And of course, with a B field, you have to reverse the B field. You have to do once a measurement running like this and once like this. So it's not from systematics, that is nicer. But with a B field, of course, you cannot do this. And there's a third option, to do a measurement with a pure magnetic ring. The big advantage is that such a ring exists. Yeah? With the Cosy ring I show in a minute. And of course, these kind of measurements can be done on a much shorter time scale. And well, you have a lower sensitivity. And of course, you have to live with this precession due to the magnetic moment. So you don't have this so-called frozen spin condition you have here and here. Frozen spin means the spin is always pointing along the momentum. Here, due to this term, the spins are always precessing. Yeah. Okay, I will mostly talk about this because we are working on this. I just show one slide for this option and for this option. And coming back to the question where this is proposed. The figure doesn't look very exciting. That is a proposal for a pure electric ring. The radius would be 50 meters, so that is, of course, one quarter of the ring. And electric field, 8 megavolt per meter. And, of course, that is for accelerator physicists. You have the bending parts here, and then you have straight sections in between with quadrupoles and all things like this. So that just got published in this review of Scientific Instrument and was driven by, I call it BNL Korea. That is Yannis Sinosidis who is behind this. He was at BNL, now is in Korea. And Fermilab was also under discussion, so they are proposing this. But not they, we are also on this paper. It's a common effort. And then in Jülich, sorry?
Could you use this technique for atoms and strip the atoms or partially?
Why not, yeah.
True. It depends on the magnetic moment.
And it depends on the vacuum, how stable these atoms are. We thought about it in COSY to run with H minus. But I think the lifetime is very limited.
So. With a magnetic moment, the issue is it's just the velocity.
No, so you want to use a frozen spin technique.
But what is the point? It is like another measurement of magnetic moment, I mean, without electric field. What is the goal?
What do you mean without electric field?
It's pure electric or pure magnetic?
This is what I showed now was pure electric?
Pure electric, yes. Okay. No, but if you're measuring pure magnetic, mm-hmm. then you're kind of normalizing to measurement of magnetic moment.
I come to this.
Okay.
So number two would be a combined ring. So you have electric and magnetic fields in the same element. So you have plates here for the radial electric fields and the magnet here. You could build a much smaller ring. So this is for the accelerator physicist, beta X, beta Y dispersion, if you're interested in it. Just to give you an idea, with these numbers, you could build such a ring. And I think the 16-meter radius are just given by experimental hall we have available in Jülich to fit this in. It's not a real limitation. So if you want to go to lower fields, of course, you have to enlarge the radius. That is somehow a trade-off. Okay. So also here, due to the combination of the E and B field, the clever combination, the spins always point parallel to the momentum vector, and you get your build-up. So now coming to this EDM measurement using a pure magnetic ring. So that is what is left from the BMT equation. So you have this precession to the B field looks like this, the precession due to the magnetic moment. Oh, let's show it like this. That is the plane of the accelerator. And you have this build-up term due to the electric moment. So the bad thing now is the spin always changes its direction. Sometimes it points forward, so parallel to the momentum vector. Sometimes it points backward. So you don't get a build-up. You get something like this due to the EDM. So the magnetic moment does this, and the electric dipole moment does this. Actually, that was used in the muon G minus 2 experiment to set a limit on the EDM of the muon. But what you would like to get is a buildup that is much easier to measure with a higher precision. So if you do it like this, you don't get a buildup. So there's a clever idea now to install somewhere in the ring a so-called magic Wien filter. There's a lot of magic in this business. Magic in the sense, it doesn't do anything to the momentum vector. Because if you set it to this condition that the Lorentz force is zero, so the W stands for Wien, then the particle just goes through because it has no electric field in its rest system, but it feels a magnetic field. So you affect the spin. And the idea is to do this at the right frequency, which is a multiple of the spin revolution frequency. And instead, the spin vector doesn't come out like this of this Wien filter, but it comes out like this, like this dotted line. So if you do it with the right frequency, with the right phase, you come to a situation where the spin vector points more than 50% parallel to the momentum vector and less than 50% antiparallel. So you get a net effect and you get a net buildup. So that is the idea how you can access an EDM in a pure magnetic ring. This buildup looks like this. So that shows the turn number or time, storage time. And this shows the vertical spin component. So you have a very fast oscillation, which goes with the spin precession frequency. In our case, it's 120 kilohertz. And if you don't have a Wien filter, this band is just like this, and you can just look at this oscillation. If you have this Wien filter, then you get a buildup. So on average, this polarization goes up as this red line. And of course, 50 turns is just, I just put it somewhere, this 50 turns corresponds to 38 milliseconds, and you want to measure for 100 or 1,000 seconds. So at the end, you will not even see this fast oscillation because the amplitude of this oscillation is very, very tiny. And at the end, you really have a buildup of a vertical polarization. So the amplitude of this fast oscillation is actually given by the electric dipole moment. So I had to choose a new parameter. Eta just is this the same as the capital G. So it is the dimensionless factor which describes the strength of the electric dipole moment. So for 10 to minus 19 E centimeters, you have an eta of 10 to minus 4. And then this oscillation here, the amplitude is 1.6 times 10 to minus 4. So it's a very tiny effect. So for the muon, you could use this because the amplitude is two orders of magnitude higher because the anomalous magnetic moment is so small of a lepton. It's 10 to minus 3. For the deuteron, it's only 10 to minus 2. So you can do this, but you lose immediately 2 orders of magnitude. Okay. Yeah. This is almost an analytic calculation. You can show this on a piece of paper. We do, of course, a lot of simulations for this, for the designing of the ring or to understand our accelerator. And just trying to show one slide on this. Where we try to investigate possible systematic issues. Of course, again here, we have unwanted radial magnetic fields, and they come mainly from misalignments of magnets. So the first thing we look into, if you use our magnetic storage ring, what do alignment do to a false buildup of the vertical polarization? Of course, the difficult part here with the simulations is that we want to track at the end 10 to 9 particles. And if you go to 10 to 1,000 seconds, you want to track for 10 to 9 turns. So we will not do this with Runge-Kutta methods. So just to give you a flavor that it's a difficult business, and special codes were written by COSY Infinity to do this tracking. And these misalignments of magnets, they turn out they are proportional to what I call a delta Y RMS. So you, in a perfect ring, this Y RMS, the Y is the vertical direction, would be zero. So the beam is perfectly on the reference particle trajectory. Because if you have misalignments, you get deviations, and you can, of course, calculate RMS. And what is shown in the next slide is, if you have misalignments or a given RMS, how large would a vertical spin build-up be, a polarization build-up, first without an EDM, and then with different assumed EDMs. And you see, if you have a perfect ring, you go down here, so that is a build-up per turn. So you, therefore, the numbers are so small. Of course, if you have 10 to 9 turns, you get a polarization you can measure. So if you have no misalignment at all, you don't get a build-up. And you see, if you have misalignments of the order of 1 millimeter, you have a build-up of 10 to minus 9 per turn. And let's assume we can go, which seems realistic, to an RMS of 0.1 millimeter. Then you have a build-up of 10 to minus 10. And you see these blue points are the same simulations, but now with the EDM built in. So 5 times 10 to minus 20. And you see that with such an alignment, the EDM effect freezes out here. So if you're in this region, you're getting to 10 to minus 20, 10 to minus 19 e-centimeters. That is roughly where the muon EDM is at the moment. So that is the first goal for us, which seems realistic in the first step. Okay. Now I would like to show some recent achievement. Well, that was already one achievement. Now I talk about experiments we did at the accelerator. And so that is the accelerator we use, COSY. So it's the cooler synchrotron. It provides polarized protons and neutrons in this momentum range. And that is just the right momentum range, and it's polarized, so it's the ideal starting point to do this kind of business. So it has a circumference of 180 meters. You see dipoles here, so bending dipoles. You have two straight sections where you can put a polarimeter and beam cooling and other things. It was used since 20 years more for hadron physics. And now the interest shifted to precision physics. Yeah, sketch. So we have a polarized proton deuterons, cooled beams. We have a polarimeter. We have different devices to manipulate the spin. I will mainly talk about things we did with the so-called radiofrequency solenoid. So you have a solenoidal field, which is longitudinal. And we have sextuples to apply some corrections. And these are the running conditions. So we took deuterons of 1 GeV, which corresponds to this beta and gamma factor. The magnetic anomaly for deuterons is minus 0.14, so that is the revolution frequency. We use different cycle lengths, 10 to 9 particles. Okay. And I mainly talk about how to maximize the spin, the so-called spin coherence time, which, as I told you, is important to keep all the spins parallel. A precise measurement of the spin precession, which is called the spin tune, feedback, and I talked a bit already about this tracking. These things I will not cover. So the experimental setup, just in a little cartoon. So we inject particles or an ensemble of particles with a polarization vector pointing upwards. So if you don't do anything, that stays there forever. Yeah, just parallel to the guiding field, which is of course also upwards. So at some point we switch on the solenoid, which has a field in this direction, and if you do this at the right frequency, you just flip your spin, you do a pi over 2 flip, and you flip your spin in the horizontal direction, and they start immediately, of course, to precess. As soon as they have a component in the horizontal plane, they start to precess according to the magnetic moment. Then we extract slowly the beam over 100 seconds, typically, or depending on the cycle lengths. And then we measure asymmetries. So we send the beam to a target, and this should be the detector, where we can measure then how many particles we got on the left side, right side, up and down. Yeah. The detector, or as a polarimeter, we use elastic deuterium carbon scattering. And that is the detector we use. It has a lot of stripes, scintillator material, but we combine them and just use a left, a right, a up and down part. That is good enough for this kind of measurements. And if you think about it, if you look at the up and down asymmetry, you get access to the spin in the horizontal plane. And if the spin points upwards, that you measure via a left-right asymmetry. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if the beam is initially like this, so the spins are parallel to the magnetic field, the measurement is quite boring. You measure, of course, given a symmetry, which is proportional to this polarization and the analyzing power. Well, if you flip the beam in the horizontal plane, things getting more interesting. The spin starts to precess, and now you look at an up-down asymmetry, which has, of course, at some point a maximum. Let's say if the spins point in this direction, it has a minimum if they point in this direction, and of course, if the spin happens to point in parallel to the momentum, you get zero asymmetry. So due to the precession, you get this pattern. And because of decoherence, so here all spins are more or less aligned, but with the time they spread out, you're losing this asymmetry. Yeah. And the time scales are very different here. So this time scale, the decay of the polarization is, as I show in a second, 10 to 1,000 seconds. And this oscillation is very, very fast. It's 120 kilohertz. So that is not, these two pictures are not to scale. You cannot see on a macroscopic time scale, you cannot see this fast oscillation. So the plots I'm going to show just show the envelope of this measurement. Okay, yeah, now some real measurements. So that shows left-right, and this shows the envelope of the up-down asymmetry. The red and the black points are just two consecutive cycles where we start once we inject particles like this and once we inject particles like this. So one color would be good enough. So here we start with the polarization like this. So you see this left-right asymmetry, and you see no up-down asymmetry. Then at this point, we flip the spin, and they start to precess. So the polarization here is zero, and we got the polarization here. And after some time, in this case, after 100 seconds, they completely decohere, so you have neither polarization here or here. Yeah. So the first goal was, of course, to increase the spin coherence time. We would like to go to 1,000 seconds to be able to do the measurement, because, of course, if the spins point in all directions, you don't get the EDM effect. And that we could do. So this shows, again, this up-down asymmetry. And just the back of the envelope calculation shows you, if you don't do anything, the spins will decohere within a second. So the delta P over P is of the order of 10 to minus 5. That leads to a delta gamma over gamma of 10 to minus 6. And the revolution period is 10 to minus 6 seconds. And the spin precession goes, I put this here, that goes with gamma G. So if you have a spread in gamma, immediately a spread of 10 to minus 6, after 10 to 6 turns or after 1 second, they completely decohere. The first thing to do is to use a bunched beam. That means if you have a particle which has a larger gamma, it gets deaccelerated in the next turn due to the RF, and this lower particle gets accelerated. Then you can cancel first order effects, and with some settings of magnets, you get to this situation where you have a spin coherence time of, let's say, 20 seconds, if you go to 1 over E. Then with clever sextuples, we were able later then to achieve 400 seconds. The 400 seconds just come from a fit to this data. Of course, if you claim that you achieved 400 seconds spin coherence time, you would like to see what happens after the 100 seconds. You don't know whether it drops down. So we, in a later run, we set up a cycle with 1,000 seconds. That is shown on this plot. The plot looks a bit boring. So here we don't have data point all over the place, because we had only extraction at this point, at this point, at this point, at this point, just because we didn't have enough particles to have a constant rate of the same rate over time as we had here, because the period was much shorter. So here, if you look at this, this is 1,400 seconds, so we reached this 1,000 seconds spin coherence time, which is one of the conditions you have to fulfill to get your statistical error down. Again, this plot looks a little bit boring. I just want to remind you that it's not just the polarization here, here, and here. There is an underlying very fast oscillation. Okay, so it's not trivial to keep this going forever. Yeah? Yeah?
Is this, I mean, a similar thing that JLab EIC design being a bigger event is trying to get away from? This spin decoherence? So they get kicked one way, and then when they come around, they...
I have to think about it, maybe. We had also some discussions on the ring 8 design. It's kind of spin echo you do in NMR to flip some of the magnetic field so that they cohere again. But here, that was done with clever sextuple settings. So I didn't mention this. That is for accelerator physicists. You go to a chromaticity zero. So what happens that you have that different particles with different momenta have different path lengths in the accelerator, and then that you can adjust with sextuples. Yeah, and if you do this, you get to this situation. So this curve is a model calculation with a few parameters, so we understand this. Was not trial and error. Yeah, so. Okay. Yeah, okay. So, yeah, there's an underlying fast rotation. So I like, since I teach first semester physics for engineers, I like to translate this to the quality factor of harmonic oscillator. So you have a decay time of 1,000 seconds, and the fast rotation is 120 kilohertz, so the Q factor is 10 to 9 for this oscillator. For this oscillator. Yeah?
So should I think of this as just...
Churchbell has a Q factor of 10 to 5 or...
What?
The Churchbell.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. 10 to 4. Tuning fork is 10 to 4. 440 hertz, it lasts for 10 seconds maybe, then you get 10,000 or something like this, yeah. Yeah.
Should I think of this as a lot of bunches, or is it just one bunch going?
It is one bunch. Well. Yes, just one bunch.
How
compact? Oh, the bunch is, I think it extends almost over one third or one fourth of the accelerator. Mm-hmm. It's not. Okay. Yeah, I just want to spend a few minutes how we measure this fast oscillation. That is not trivial to get this point. It seems too easy just to measure a symmetry, but it's not what it is. So this fast oscillation, it's called spin tune in accelerator physics. So it's the number of spin rotations per number of particle revolutions. So for tutorons, and it's given by gamma g. So for tutorons of 1 GeV with this gamma factor, the spin tune is 0.16. And this angle, so the spin enters like this, and after one turn, it's here, it's 2 pi gamma g, which is roughly 60 degrees. So after six turns, it makes one revolution. And remember, one turn is 1 microsecond, roughly. So over 1,000 seconds, you observe a lot of this. So the problem is the following. We have a detector rate of about 5 kilohertz. That means the detector signal, or the functional form, is like this. If you just look at the upper detector, or the lower detector would just be the inverse, of course. And with this rate, we observe like one event every 25th period. So something like this, you have an event here. Well, you not even have an event here. You would have it after 25 periods. But just to indicate the problem, you cannot just plot this and do a chi-square fit like it was done for the G-2 experiment with the cycle time was a millisecond. Yeah. So you have to invent some clever methods to unfold this fast precession. So we tried different things, and it turned out that, well, as very often, the Fourier analysis helped here. So what we do, we take a macroscopic time bin of 10 to 6 turns, which is roughly 1 second, and just do a Fourier analysis. And the Fourier, even if you have event distributions like this, the Fourier analysis doesn't care. And what you get, If you scan this precession frequency, or the spin tune, which is just the dimensionless number proportional to this frequency, you get, of course, a nice peak. And from this Fourier analysis, in the first 10 to 6 turns, you get a phase and you get an amplitude. And we keep the phase. And then we do for the next 10 to 6 seconds, we again look at the phase, but for a fixed frequency. We just choose not an arbitrary frequency, but a frequency in this region here. And we look at the phase in every 10 to 6 turns. And that is what comes out. So the phase versus particle turns or time. Yeah. And of course, if this spin tune is rock solid and stable, and you choose initially the correct frequency in this plot, yeah, then you get a straight line here. If you're slightly off with your frequency, it doesn't matter, you just get a slope in your frequency, and the slope in the frequency gives you this direction factor.
But the detector is really steady in terms of its frequency, it's not changing at all?
Well, even if efficiency changes, I think for this frequency, it's hard to imagine an effect. We tried different Monte Carlos. It's hard to imagine an effect which shifts the frequency. Yeah. So what we observe is something like this. So you can do many things. One thing is from two consecutive runs, the phase difference tells you how much the frequency changed from step to step. That we did here. So you get a delta spin tune, that is the deviation from the spin tune we assumed initially. That you can, for instance, use in an online measurement where you want to track the spin evolution and correct for it. Or you can do a fit to all this phase, measurement, and then you get a much higher precision. And you can measure this spin tune to a precision of 10 to minus 10, the average value. So this is a result from a fit, parabolic fit. So if you have a parabolic shape here, that means the spin tune, if the phase changes quadratically, the frequency shifts linearly. And this error band is then the statistical error band. Of course, the highest precision you get somewhere in the middle. It's not exactly in the middle because here we have smaller error bars because the coherence, the spin didn't decohere.
The middle figure, the bottom one, could be zoomed in with
sitting on the top of that. No. Here you gain two orders of magnitude because you use the whole time window.
Yeah, I'm just wondering.
And here,
first we have the same information.
Well, they have essentially the same information, but look at the scale here.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. If you put it in
there. Here, this is just not the most clever way to do it, but if you want to use this online and correct, you have to do it like this. Therefore, I show also this figure. But if you want to get the highest precision, you have it here. Okay. Yeah. So we can do this in one cycle of 100 seconds to 10 to minus 10. It's always interesting to compare this to muon g minus 2. So the relative precision would be 10 to minus 9. G minus 2 reaches 10 to minus 6 per year, and we reach 10 to minus 9 in 100 seconds. So it's not because they are stupid. Of course, in the g minus 2 experiment, you measure for 1 microsecond. Here we have the 100 seconds. And one game I like to play, my colleagues don't like this. So imagine you have no magnetic moment, but you had only electric dipole moment. Of course, you get a spin tune as well, because then the electric dipole moment causes a spin revolution. And well, for electric dipole moment of 10 to minus 24, you get a spin tune of 10 to minus 11. So statistically, we are in this region in 100 seconds because of the long measuring time. Of course, that doesn't help you because you have in addition rotations due to the magnetic moment and due to the reflections. But statistically, I think it's easy to go there. Yeah, we used now the spin tune for various tests and tools for systematic studies. And we used it also for a feedback system, but I think I skip this part. And I just show that we have a nice collaboration, which is called JEDI. I don't like the name, but it was already there when I came. So it stands for Jülich Electric Dipole Moment Investigations, about 100 members. We allow even for theorists, you see here on this picture. yeah, there is a close collaboration with the storage ring EDM collaboration in the US and Korea. So we are looking more into this option combined ring, they in the pure electric ring. And yeah, what else? If you want to read more about it, there is an article in the CERN Career of September this year. And we just got a ERC grant for, which is a big thing in Europe, for 5 years. So that at least that saves us to be closed in the next 5 to 6 years. It just started a month ago. So see how the decision go in Germany. You shut us down, and months later you get this grant. okay. Yeah. short summary. See, I stop here. Yeah, I think the first thing is clear that EDMs are of high interest. And I hope I could convince you that EDMs of charged particles can be measured in storage ring. The experiment is very challenging because the effect is so tiny. But our first results, which I showed you, the spin coherence time, this precise spin tune measurement, the feedback system I skipped, look promising. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
So what about, say, the measurement of, say, magnetic moment? Are you planning to do this as well?
No.
No.
No. The reason is simple. Well, the magnetic moment is known to 10 to minus 10. I don't know for the deuteron. So the measurement.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, for deuteron, I think the same order.
Yeah.
So the measurement of your vertical spin component is always proportional, of course, either to the magnetic moment and the magnetic field or to the electric field and the electric dipole moment. So if you want to get to 10 to minus 9, you have to know your field, your integrated field to 10 to minus 9. No way. Of course, for the EDM, we will have a statistical error of 100%. So if you know your electric field to 10%, that's good enough. So that is the reason. What we were thinking about with the spin tune measurement, if we could get polarized antiprotons, you run them in the same ring, and you measure the spin precession for the protons and the antiprotons, you could make a CPT test.
To 10 to minus 10.
10 to 10 to minus 10. That is in 100 seconds, so you can. But you need polarized antiprotons.
I mean, for electron proton,
it was done in Novosibirsk.
Yeah.
But they flipped in the horizontal plane and went back. So we could, of course, in situ measure the polarization, the precession in the plane. Yeah, exactly. It would be a copy of this Novosibirsk measurement. Yeah.
How does the experiment, the difficulty vary as a function of the mass of the ion?
No, I don't see any reason why it should.
Difficulty is, of course, the preparation, right? I mean, you need the source for the ion.
Yeah.
And you need, would like an ion with a positive anomalous magnetic moment that would be fluorine 19 would be a very good candidate.
You're always zero magnetic moment. It would even be better. Or very close to zero.
Yeah, but you would have not identified zero. So, I mean, when you would like to have.
Well, for the lepton, you have 10 to minus 3, which helps.
Because fluorine 19 would be the first candidate. I mean, unfortunately, triton would be always a nice candidate, but it has other issues.
Yeah.
But
why are you asking?
I'm just curious. Now, if you go in the other direction and try to do this with the electron, what goes wrong? Is it just simply the EDM is so small that you wouldn't expect to see anything at all?
For the electron?
Yeah.
To measure it for the electron directly. No, we were thinking about it. The nice thing is that this magic momentum is 15 MeV. Yeah, because the magnetic moment, so to cancel. Yeah, so to cancel this term here. So you need a 15 MeV electron beam, which would fit in a small area. The polarimetry is not so easy to measure the polarization of a 15 MeV. It was done, but at backward angles. So that is one issue. But we were discussing with people in Bonn. They run an electron accelerator with polarized electrons too.
But for electron, you should compete with this measurement by Gabriel, say, whatever, which is pretty.
But they don't have an electron measurement. They have a thorium oxide measurement,
but I mean,
would be my argument. I don't know. Yeah. Well, someday, if they measure a finite value, then people will ask how solid is the all the way through this different layers to get to the electron. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Of course, it will be hard to beat this in the near future.
Yeah.
But we discussed this, but we cannot open too many boxes because.
Let me ask a practical question. So you have a 5-year grant now from the European science people. That's great. But 5 years takes you to about the point where they want to shut COSY down.
Yeah.
So there's a
Yeah.
How do you see yourself being able to get the measurement by that time, or using a promising start to somehow keep the accelerator open? How do you do that?
Well, the 5 years will bring us somewhere here. We hope to do a first measurement in 18, 19. So 5 years would be till 21. My first hope is, 2 years ago we were told that it's great that the shift from hadron physics to this precision experiment, that's the right thing to do with this accelerator. A year later, the management changed and changed the direction by 180 degrees. So my hope is that in 1 or 2 years, who knows what happens. What else can I do?
Yes.
And my focus is now really on this what we call a precursor experiment at COSY, to get something done on charged hadrons. So other people propose, give me $100 million, I build you a ring and measure it to 10 to minus 29. I think that will not work. You have to go step by step.
And of course, the 5 years are for the first part, the 10 to minus 24.
Yeah, it will even be hard to get to 10 to minus 24. But to do a first measurement, and to see what you can do and where you have to improve. Well, the idea is, because they want to shut COSY down, but they realize that there are at least, I don't know, 10, 15 people with tenured position, they have to do something. And the idea is that we continue to write a design report for a dedicated ring and hand this report to somebody else who built the ring. It's like if you build a car factory.
This is an engineer.
Which is, yeah, it's a, was heißt Verfahrenstechniker? It's, yeah, the
it's
engineer who is the the head of the lab. He thinks in these categories. Yeah.
This thing being recorded.
But you know, I mean, COSY was created at least 20 years ago, and nobody could have imagined to find a spin tune of 10 to minus 10.
No, of
right?
course not, yeah.
Well, the machine that was not built to that standard.
So. No, it was absolutely not clear. If you look at this picture, that the stability of the machine was good enough that that we see something like this. It could have been much more erratic, I don't know, because of instabilities of power supplies. So we were surprised to see this. So this stability or the change of the spin tune by, I don't know, what is it, 10 to minus 9, means that this gamma factor over the cycle changed by 10 to minus 9, which is proportional to the energy. Nobody knew that the machine was that stable. Yeah, you have delta P over P of 10 to minus 5, so that was is an interesting tool, maybe also for other applications. Yeah.
Well, anyway, thank you, Eric.